This week on Future of Sex.
They don't see the person. They don't see me as me, just a normal person. They see the disability.
Being a quadriplegic doesn't stop me. Just being paralyzed doesn't stop me from being in a relationship or being physical or making love or anything like that, if I'm with the right person. Because if I'm with the right person, I don't feel like I'm paralyzed.
Because able-bodied people and non-disabled people get to have the discussion of what feels good when it comes to sex and disability, and disabled people, unfortunately, don't. They're stuck in risk. They're stuck in, if you engage sexually with a disabled person, you could hurt them.
They just don't know how to talk to disabled people about anything, let alone, you know, flirt with us or have conversations about having sex with us.
The disabled community is actually the largest minority group in the world, but it's also the one that probably has the least representation.
So when I come, it's like, it feels like I'm breaking free of so many things.
Hey, I'm Bryony, and welcome to Future of Sex, the podcast that explores the evolving worlds of sex and tech. Here we are for our second episode in our second season, sponsored by WeVibe. And this week, we're talking about sex and disability, two taboos that people struggle to talk about separately, let alone when we mix them together. And because of that, there are still lots of myths about sex and disability lurking around, like people with disability are often perceived as asexual, or they can't have sex, or they're perceived as being hypersexual. Well, today we're here to bust these myths by talking candidly with some real voices in the disability community. Before we get started, we just want to remind you this podcast contains explicit language and adult themes, so make sure you got headphones in if there are little ones around.
I remember I was watching this person get undressed. I was in the bed watching this person get undressed and just thinking, wow, I get to do this. This is great. And so, so I finished early. As you do when you've never done this before. And afterwards, I said, wow, we should totally go for a coffee. Let's go for pizza. Because I honestly thought and believed that when you do that with somebody, you must be in a relationship. I was very, very young, and I just wanted to feel wanted by somebody. So I kind of pushed that along. And then I remember him looking at me straight in the face and saying, no, do you see your chair over there? And I said, yeah. And he pointed to my wheelchair. I was in my bed. And he said, well, I came by because I felt bad for you. You were just a pity fuck. And I remember just looking up at the ceiling and just thinking, okay, how do I react but maintain my composure and not break down? I was so hurt because I knew people may have felt that way about people with disabilities, but I'd never been confronted with it so head on.
Today, the taboo and misconceptions around disability mean there is almost a complete lack of innovation in the field of sexuality to help the hundreds of millions of people around the world that can't masturbate due to hand limitations from pain, immobility, lack of dexterity, weakness, etc. So I spoke to the incredible brother-sister duo who are about to change all that with their new company, Handy, designing sex tech with disability in mind and creating not only products, but a movement that will tear down taboo and talk openly about all things sex and disability. And as Andrew and Heather both told me, no topic is out of bounds for this interview.
I work specifically talking about my experience of being disabled, being a wheelchair user, being queer, not only trying to access sex, but giving people an understanding of what it is to live as a disabled person, because that's something people don't really have an experience of and don't really know how to navigate those conversations. So my job is to bring that forward and allow people to learn about disability through my experience. My name is Andrew Gerza. I am the Chief Disability Officer at Handy, and I'm a disability awareness consultant. I live with cerebral palsy and I'm a wheelchair user. I've been working as a freelance disability consultant in this space now, building my own brand for about, I want to say, the better part of a decade.
My name's Heather Morrison. I am the co-founder and CEO of Handy. We are on a mission to put pleasure within reach, and we're starting by creating the first line of sex toys for disabled people. I mean, Andrew's work that he's done as a sex and disability activist, you know, for the last decade does mean that whether or not you wanted to see your brother in leathers, you saw your brother in leathers and you got really comfortable, probably more than most, talking to your siblings and your family just in general about things around sex and sexuality. Not that our family dynamic was ever conservative. It definitely wasn't, which is probably why Andrew found so much comfort in being able to sort of let his freak flag fly. But I think because of the work he's done, we did have this kind of open conversation just generally, and we're a little bit more open with each other. And it was on the back of a documentary Andrew had done a while ago called
Picture This.
As a sister watching it was quite heartbreaking at times, but also pretty illuminating. And off the back of that, we were having a conversation because it was during this documentary where Andrew was talking about the his loss of being able to masturbate and self-pleasure and what that felt like and what that meant for him. And until I had watched that, I had no idea. And I think a lot of people we talk to about this idea have this we watch them have the same light bulb moment that I had, in that I never thought about that, but now that I've thought about it, it makes so much sense. And I can't believe there's things out there that don't exist. And so we were talking about that, and Andrew was kind of sort of schooling me on what his lived experience was and the fact that there aren't any toys or aids out there specifically related to sex and disability, or the ones that were on the market just weren't quite meeting the cut. And so, yeah, very naively, we decided to, you know, go on this journey to start to fix and change that, not realizing what that actually entailed. But, you know, there's been a lot of research that we've done in this, on this journey, and a lot of it has used Andrew as kind of the case study. And so at the beginning that when we were doing the research, like I would say to Andrew, well, you just send through your research findings, because we were sending Andrew like buckets of sex toys to try out and like his findings. Like, he definitely got the fun end of that research. I love it. And, you know, I kind of said, you just send your findings straight through to the researchers, Andrew. I don't need to see them. But I think, like, as being so integral to the business, to really understand where the barriers are from a product design perspective, eventually I was able to kind of divorce myself from not wanting to read it and just divorce myself from the fact that this is my brother and kind of like weirdness around that kind of is around there, but actually needing to know where the barriers were and what his experience was. You know, most siblings wouldn't have that kind of dialogue, but at the same time, I'm able to understand his lived experience so much better. And I'm also able to have a lot more, I guess, empathy around it, but also really understanding like the bigness of the problem we're trying to solve and how deep it runs from an emotional perspective within people. It's not just about having fun, and it's not just about having a toy. It's actually such a deeper human need and human right that we're looking at really making a difference around. And
I think that, you know, when Heather and I launched this, I was really shy to talk with her about what my experiences were, because she's my older sister, and we never, until we started doing this, we never really had a relationship where we would like share our, you know, sexy moments with each other, because that's just not what you did. And then as this started coming together and me realizing that she wanted to go on this journey with me, which was, I think, really powerful for me. There was a photo shoot we took in Toronto last October where we were just goofing off with boas and just playing around with the photographer. And that's one of my favorite photo shoots we've done, because it showed me that, like, I can talk about this stuff with my sister. And there's a picture of us. One of us said something silly, and we're just cackling, laughing. And I have that picture on my computer, and I look at it every day because it reminds me that, like, okay, we can do this. And so I think it was really scary to talk to her about those things, because I didn't want to seem, you know, it's just weird to talk about that with your sister. But much like she's divorced herself from the weirdness, you really start to get comfortable being like, oh yeah, this happened, and now we will phone each other like once a week and have a discussion about what happened and about what I'm feeling and about how Sex and Disability feels this week. So it's something that not only is it a business, it's something that really, like Heather said, has brought us way, way closer than I think either of us had expected it to. And I'm really excited by that. That makes me very, very happy, because I thought for a long time that we wouldn't have the kind of relationship where I could share this stuff, and now we do. And that aside from the business, that part makes me really proud.
Even parents listening to this podcast and thinking about how do you create an environment where, you know, your kids can grow up and talk about sex as a normal thing to their siblings, because it is normal. And I think you're setting an example to anybody out there that has a brother or sister to be able to talk about stuff that is so personal and so important to our life, right? Like, we have such a big issue with talking about sex to anyone we're close with, and especially the people we're having sex with, but even family and growing up, right? So I think that's pretty awesome and huge. Aside from the business and everything you guys are doing in designing toys for, you know, varying disabilities, and I know there's...
Yeah, to touch on your point, so the World Health Organization has said that sexual pleasure is a human right, which is fantastic, which just gives us a really lovely platform to fight for that ability. Mm. When we stumbled across that, when we first started on this, it was like the holy grail of, you know, just being able to explain to people why it's so important to be able to position it as a human right just gives it that much more of a sort of elevated platform.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I think, like, to your point as well, like around sort of, and I think Andrew would be great to hear your thoughts on like some of the conversations you had with like mom and just how our family dynamics work. But like one of the things, it just in terms of, you know, people not being able to talk to people about sex and sexuality and sort of there always being that it's like it's normal, but nobody talks about it. When we were talking to people within the disabled communities recently, we found like, you know, if it's hard for people to talk, just anybody to talk about sex, when you start to layer disability on top of that, it gets even more taboo. And so we did find that the inability to talk or the reluctance to talk about it within disabled families that have a disabled person in them as well as even more increased probably than families without people with disabilities, because there is a sort of, I guess, incorrect assumption that people with disabilities might be asexual or non-sexual, might not be interested, they might be vulnerable. And so all of these sort of things from a cultural but also a systemic level mean that there's not actually as much of an outlet for many people with disabilities to talk about their sexuality or sexual needs without feeling sense of shame or that they shouldn't be having these feelings because of the sort of cultural taboo and even systemic taboos that reside in and around sex and disability.
And I would agree with what Heather's saying. I mean, I think that a lot of the people we've spoken to and I've spoken to in my work have said, you know, it was really hard for me as a disabled person to talk about sex because my mom is my caregiver also. And so how can I talk to her about sex if she has to help me in the bathroom or in the shower, or how can I do that? And it's really hard for me. And so I think that, you know, to my family's credit, my mom, she's a feisty one. She never made it uncomfortable to talk about that stuff. And her and I have had conversations. We were on the BBC last year talking about how I sometimes will hire a sex worker to have my needs met. And we did a whole interview where I talked to my mom about hiring a sex worker. And that was like being able to have that conversation with her, not only like on the radio, on like an international radio show, but also just as her son, showed me that like none of this, it's okay for me to be a little bit bolder, to talk about this stuff, to let it out of the bag. And so, and also I think because she's been taking care of me since I was young and has done even as an adult, we've gone on trips together and I've hired her as my attendant to go to conferences and things, and she'll be the one that has to help me in the bathroom and do all this stuff. And so I'm very thankful that part of our relationship, because she's had to do my care, means that we're not shy about stuff. The body isn't scary. It's just something that's there and we can talk about it. So I'm thankful in a way that my disability has had, you know, forced me to need care, because it allowed me to get much more relaxed about body stuff and then could easily bridge the gap when it was time to be like, hey mom, guess what? I think I'm queer. Hey mom, guess what? I hire sex workers. Like, it wasn't scary because they've been there when I needed to use the bathroom or needed to get put into bed or changed, or, you know, so it my disability and all my needs allow for those conversations to flow a lot easier, I think. And I would feel ashamed, but now I just feel very proud that I, because of my disability and my body limitations, it forced me to be much more vocal about what I wanted and how I was going to get it.
This season of Future of Sex is brought to you by our partners at WeVibe. When it comes to couples vibrators, there's no other company we'd recommend more than WeVibe. They're our favourites and industry leaders for a reason. They're consistently bringing innovation to sex toys. Today, we're offering our listeners a 5% discount code at the WeVibe online store. All you need to do is visit www.wevibe.com or visit the link on our Insta bio at Future of Sex. And when you found what you want, enter the code FUTURE at the checkout for your discount. Did you know there are around 1 billion people in the world who live with some form of disability, making up about 15% of the global population? In fact, if people with disabilities were a formally recognised minority group, they would be the largest minority group in the world. In the US alone, people living with a disability make up almost 20% of the population in the US. And one day, you too might form part of this group if you don't already. As we age, many of us will develop disabilities. So, what misconceptions do you have about disabled people and sex? Or if you're living with a disability, what do you wish other people knew about it?
We're kind of talking like just about disabled people as if they're a rare breed. But actually, if you look around your family, like especially older members of your family, you will start to see people with disabilities, whether that's arthritis or, you know, something more serious, having to have a hip replacement, you know, that's disability. And has that ever changed your perspective of a person? I hope not. And again, it's just this normalization of disability that needs to occur. Like, just because we're younger, and you might not expect to see a younger person sat in a wheelchair,
we're seen as having so many issues, and we have to be pitied, and, you know, my legs don't work. Why would I think about sex? Which is just, so for me, like, it's so disconnected. But for an able-bodied person who doesn't either experience disability or doesn't, you know, interact with people who experience disability, you know, that's, like, it makes sense to them. If your body doesn't work the way theirs does, then you must not be interested in sex. I don't get it.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm 29. I live in England and I'm a part-time wheelchair user and full-time disabled person.
Do you think people are scared of having sex with people with disabilities?
Oh my God, absolutely. I think that's an enormous issue, and I think that that's something that can only be tackled through more representation in the mainstream media. Like, not only are they scared, I mean, having sex with us, I don't even think that's a thought. I think they're, you know, scared to say hello to us half the time. It's so funny, when I'm out in my wheelchair, people obviously don't realise they're doing it, and I wouldn't have realised they were doing it if it didn't happen all the time. But the most common thing, if somebody turns around, even if, like, I'm nowhere near them, rather than saying hello or smiling or whatever, they'll go, oh, sorry. And obviously, I live in England, so that is it's a pretty normal thing to hear at any given time. But it's every time they look at me, and it's just kind of that, I think it's surprise coupled with oh gosh, am I doing something wrong because this disabled person is here, and oh no, I don't want to offend them, or oh gosh, what if I get in their way, what if they need help and I don't help them properly, or what if I try and help them and they don't want me to, like they just don't know how to talk to disabled people about anything, let alone, you know, flirt with us or have conversations about having sex with us. Recently I've been working on the handy book of Love, Lust and Disability. It's a book of curated quotes. So we've reached out to artists, activists, influencers from all around the world, all disabled people, of course. And they have been incredibly honest and raw and vulnerable and answered all of our questions in ways that we just didn't expect. And it's all coming together to make this really exciting book of quotes, talking about areas of sex and disability that I've never seen in mainstream media or other types of media before.
What have you learned through interviewing all these people that surprised you?
Oh, so many things. There's just not one way that disability can affect your sexuality. So, for example, one of the sections is all about the sort of pain and pleasure paradox, like can you have one without the other, can you have both at the same time if you live with chronic pain. And what we found was a lot of our contributors are actually exploring pain through kink and BDSM, and some of them are using pain in a controlled way to achieve sexual pleasure, whereas others are inflicting pain in order to kind of feel that control. And it's interesting to see the different ways that that plays out. Yeah, I think a large proportion of our contributors do live with chronic pain of some kind. That is a daily situation. I'm one of those contributors with daily pain. And it has such a sort of all-pervasive impact because it is literally there all the time. I think when able-bodied people think about chronic pain, it's like, well, if it's chronic and it's all the time, it must be lesser somehow, right? But no, it still hurts exactly the same as on day one. So for example, I have a condition where my joints dislocate daily, and that is very painful, but you know, I'm not going to hospital, I'm not screaming, I'm not reacting the same as anybody else would, but there's nothing to say that it hurts me less.
Mm.
So I think when we live with that kind of pain in our lives, it does have such an effect on us that it's inevitably going to kind of bleed into our sexuality.
Yeah, that sounds like the most amazing release. It's like drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've joked before, like, it's better than liquid morphine, and none of my able-bodied friends get to try that either.
So have you always been in a wheelchair for your chronic pain?
No, the wheelchair has been a fairly new develop over the last sort of 2 to 3 years, but it's my usage of it has been steadily increasing over that time. I actually think I should have got it way earlier than I did, but because of sort of internalized ableism, it just didn't seem like an option for me. So I always felt like I wasn't disabled enough. That's something that we see a lot in the book as well, that people don't feel disabled enough to start using their mobility aids for whatever reason. But also just because I was terrified of, like, well, this means surely that I won't be able to go anywhere or do anything ever again because you don't see young people around in wheelchairs. So surely that means that they don't do anything. But of course, that isn't true. It was scary and it was an adjustment. And yeah, definitely internalized ableism has put me back a lot of times. Again, when I started using crutches probably 5 years ago, I just didn't want to be seen as different. I didn't want to be seen as my disability. And yeah, I didn't want to be treated any differently. And I was. But it's about coming to terms with it and choosing what's best for you. So what's best for me is that I get to go out and do things on days where chronic pain or chronic fatigue would have kept me at home before. So I will always use my mobility aids and, like, My wheelchair feels like freedom now.
The terms that you're describing of like, yeah, resisting that sort of and the internalized ableism, how did it in your mind affect dating and relationships? And was that a big part of it, of the sort of, I guess, the fear factor of admitting these things?
Oh, absolutely. So I've been with my partner now for 6 years. So I was sort of 23 when I was last single. And I was also a lovely big fat girl. And I was already meeting enough fat phobia, especially in dating, that I just didn't want to add another layer of reasons to reject me. And what I realise now is that actually that is quite a brilliant way to weed out assholes, because you already know if someone's contacting you that this isn't the kind of person that's put off by someone because they're fat or put off by someone because they're disabled. And guess what? You never know if you're going to get fat. You never know if you're going to get disabled. And I'm quite happy being with someone that I know can take all of those things and still love me and see my worth and value as a person.
Well, you know, majority of us will end up disabled in some way or using a mobility aid in some way at some point in our life.
The statistic is, 80% of disabled people were born non-disabled. So that's an enormous population of able-bodied people that will become disabled at some point. And we need to have that representation there already so that people know what it means to be disabled. Like, we see people, you know, questioning whether that means they can still be sexy, still be desirable. Am I still worthy of commitment? And people are made to feel pretty awful about it. You can absolutely still be a complex, beautiful, sexy human and disabled. It is important when having conversations with disabled people, if you're hoping to move the conversation in the direction of sex and sexuality, you need to make sure that, same with any other person that you would talk to, that you know them properly, that you feel like they'd be comfortable talking about that. Because what we found out from the book as well is so many people are approached and asked the most ridiculous questions. So we've got like 90% of people too scared to talk to disabled people. And then the 10% that are getting through are saying the worst things you can imagine. Like, does your dick work? Can you have sex? God, you're hot for a disabled person. You know, these kind of really dismissive, intrusive questions or statements. And it's like, consider what the answer could be, I guess, before asking a very intrusive question. I'm hoping the future of sex will be accessible. I'm hoping that more sex toys or even things like, you know, orgies, group sex, parties become more accessible, that the queer community becomes more accessible, and that disabled people are represented better and can have more fulfilling sex lives as a part of society.
I just want to take a quick break to tell you about an app called Lover, which you might have heard me mention before, and I'm super excited about. Designed by Professor of Sexual Medicine, Dr. Brittany Blair and her team, Lover helps you identify the sexual issue you want to work on. It can be anything from performance anxiety to not reaching climax in bed, and it creates a personalized treatment plan of scientific techniques and exercises to follow. And they're seeing crazy changes for users. 92% of women reach orgasm more easily after doing the exercises in the app. It's amazing. So get yourself over to lover.io today, or just search for Lover in the App Store. Sex ed in so many ways is the starter to our own personal stories about sex and sexuality. And in many ways, I feel like improving sex education all over the globe feels like a big solution to so many issues for all of us. So I was interested to learn about Andrew's experience, like what the future of sex ed and disability might look like from a point of hope, and why so many of the messages we give to young people about their bodies is that it's wrong, and especially for people with disabilities. There seems to be this tendency to be fearful rather than truly explore what feels good in your body.
Sex ed is often a part of physical education courses or classes. And so if you've got any sort of disability, whether that's visible or invisible, a lot of times you're taken out of physical education classes.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of my phys ed experience or sex ed experience, I was asked multiple times from high school onwards, do you really need to be in this class? Would you rather go do something else? And I was shy and awkward and didn't want to make trouble. So I would usually say, cool, a free period? Okay, great, I'm going to go do that instead, not realizing how maybe I should have been there. Also, I was realizing that I was queer at the time. So I was like, do I really need to watch a birthing video about the kind of sex that I want to have? Maybe not so much.
Watch that video.
So where did you find your sex ed then, Andrew?
I'm still finding it right now. It's still something that I'm learning as I go and having kind of self-propel myself into this space. I'm learning as I go, and I'm learning through experience now as a, you know, mid-30s person and having dealt with ableism in the sexual space and sexual ableism from the time I started being sexually active at like 19, and learning kind of what I could and couldn't do on the fly kind of as I was doing it is how I learned. And I would love to see sex education classes taught by people with varying levels of disability to disabled people, because when you have disabled people in a room talking to each other who are not being in a professorial, being talked at sense, when you're sitting in a room with a bunch of disabled people just shooting the shit about sex, the conversation changes and you see people with disabilities start to relax and start to feel comfortable and start to tell parts of their story that they might not tell a non-disabled educator. So I think I would love to see more classes that are geared specifically to disabled bodies and taught by disabled people.
One big thing I think is this nervousness around the population or the disabled community being vulnerable and being vulnerable to abuse or, you know, sexual misconduct or those sorts of things. Like, how do you talk about that? Or I don't even know where to start with that, because it just seems like such an off-limits topic for people.
Yeah, I think it's important to call that out and speak for what it is, because you're right. Disabled people are at a higher risk of abuse and at a higher risk of sexual assault and a higher risk of sexual misconduct. All of that is true. That's not a misprint. That's true. But the problem with this, I think, in sex education is that all we ever see as disabled people is, if you're talking to your disabled person about, or your disabled, you know, student or your disabled child about sex, let them know about the risk. There is then no conversation about, oh, but you can also let them know about the pleasurable parts of sex. You can talk to them about what feels good. You can talk to them about why sex with their disabilities could be challenging. There's no discussion about that gets into the weeds of it. There's just, oh no, sex and disability is a risk because they're vulnerable. Oh no, which really, you know, infantilizes the disabled person and makes them, again, takes away their agency to decide if they want to be a part of the sexual community, if they want to access sex. It doesn't give them the choice, because you're saying, you immediately tell them, oh no, sex is bad. So when I was like a young kid and I would see things like, you know, I would see little or things like, you know, sex and disability is a risk. And I would see like pamphlets about that on the internet when I was kind of doing my own education and learning, I would see sex and disability as a risk. So I'd be like, okay, well, I guess I won't have sex and disability because I'm at risk. And so there was really no discussion of where's the joy? Where's the pleasure? Where's the fun in this? Because able-bodied people and non-disabled people get to have the discussion of what feels good when it comes to sex and disability. And disabled people, unfortunately, don't. They're stuck in risk. They're stuck in, if you engage sexually with a disabled person, you could hurt them. You could be, you know, it could be sexual misconduct. And that conversation is really damning to a disabled person, especially a young disabled person that's trying to learn about what feels good in their body when they have no signs that say it's okay to do this.
So right now, I mean, your website exists, your book's being written, your product's being developed. Like, how are you wanting people to engage with Handy right now? Is it more awareness and like building out, Andrew, all the platform you've created already?
I mean, we would love for them to engage with us. Tell us a story, to really just tell us about how sex and disability, what it means for them and how it feels for them, because it's through their story that we can then know what our next steps are and know the next thing we want to tackle. And their story helps us to build our brand. It isn't about Heather and I building a brand. It's about what can we give back to this, to these communities, these disabled communities who are, you know, based on our research, are longing for this kind of discourse and this kind of discussion. They really want it. So we would just love to engage with them in whatever way they want to do that, whether that be through social media, whether that be through emails to us, letting us know, you know, why it's important to them, whether they want to, you know, contribute to the book, whatever, however they want to engage with us. Mm. We are happy to have that conversation.
Andrew, do you ever get tired of talking about sex?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes, yeah, but I remember that it's when I talk about sex, and this project has helped me to realize that it isn't just about sex. It's about feeling good in your body. It's about access. It's about what does that mean? So it's never just about the how does Andrew have sex? It's or how do I experience sex? It's about how do I experience my body? How do I experience pleasure? How do I experience discomfort around my body, you know, body dysmorphia because of disability and ableism. So I try not to think about it like, oh man, I'm so tired about talking about sex. I try to think about it from a broader sense of like, how can I talk about my experiences as a disabled body person right now? And also I recognize that by me talking about it, even if I have days where I'm like, oh, I don't want to talk about this, I know that by doing that, I can give somebody else who may be sitting at home, who may be 15, 16, looking for something to where they can feel represented, I can give them something to do that with. Mm-hmm. They can look at me and go, oh, wow, there's a version of me in here somewhere. I feel better about this now because I saw Andrew do it, or Andrew mm-hmm. talked about this. So now I can talk about it too.
Thanks for listening to Future of Sex. If you have any questions or feedback or just want to keep up with what I'm doing, follow me on Instagram at Future of Sex. And of course, we'd love you to rate and review this podcast, or if you enjoyed it, just forward it to a friend. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.